Okay, anything else anyone would like to share? All right, well,
Mr. Chair Lloyd, I'm going to start the recording. It talks to us now, that's why I have to tell you, so.
Thank you, okay.
Recording in progress.
Okay, so we are officially on the record. For the last 3 weeks, I've been on the road. Um, 50 years ago this month, on June 13th, my Abby and I got married on Pescadero Beach, about 60 miles south of San Francisco on the California coast. And so last January, when we both got vaccinated, we decided that, well, you know, if the country's opened up by then, we want to do a road trip. It would be our first road trip in a couple of years, in which we drive out to California and retrace our steps from the place where we got married, and then going up the coast and into the Cascades and the Sierras, because we spent the summer of 1971. Our honeymoon was a summer-long backpacking excursion, you know, into the backcountry and all these mountain ranges. I had a promise of a job back in the Bay Area, but we had no address and very little money, so we spent the whole summer on the road. And so we decided we wanted to go to as many of those places as possible. So I want to spend, the next, 15 minutes or so just talking about that trip, you know, the one 50 years ago and the one we just completed, and then reflect together perhaps on what it means to go forth and what it means to be at home, and how our feelings about who we are and how we interact with the world are affected in that way. Because, you know, like Bhante Anolio says, you know, meditation practice is very much about finding your home, your place of refuge, your place of safety, and then venturing forth to the edge, venturing forth to the edge of the unknown, and being willing to step into the unknown a little bit at a time and explore the not knowing, and to become comfortable with the not knowing, even as you remember where you came from. So be looking at those kinds of issues together as well. So Abby and I had been living together for about a year or so when we decided to go ahead and get married. And we had lived together in a little cabin in the mountains, the forested mountains of northern Arizona. We both had a lot of close friends in the Bay Area, so we went out there. We just called up our family, and this was, you know, at a time when, I don't know, things were in flux. We were deeply embedded in the counterculture at the time. We just said, well, hey, we decided to get married, and we're going to do it on this state beach down south San Francisco, and if you'd like to join us, you're welcome to, but it's no big deal. And so Abby's parents drove from central Pennsylvania, and my folks drove from Tucson, Arizona, and we all get together and sat in a circle on Pescadero Beach. And a good friend, the friend who actually, you know, sort of helped introduce us, joined the Universal Life Church in order to be the officiant for our marriage, because in California at the time, you needed to have an officiant. And so the Universal Life Church was founded by the Reverend Kirby J. Hensley in order to make it possible for anyone not member of an Orthodox denomination to marry people. And so you could get the Masters of Divinity degree simply by writing him and asking for one, if you wanted the Doctorate of Divinity degree, you had to pay $20. So our minister decided that she would just become a Master's of Divinity so that she could marry us. And so we got married on Pescadero Beach. And I had an offer of a job. It was to start in the fall running an outdoor action program, like a mini Outward Bound program for students at Berkeley High School. But until then, we had no income and we had nowhere to live. What we did have was our 1969 VW van that we had built a bed into and some storage space, and Abby had made some blue and orange paisley curtains for it. And so we spent the summer of 1971 on the road. You know, we drove up the coast from the Bay Area, and we went to the town of Mendocino, and we admired these lovely little B&Bs, you know, and cheeky restaurants that we couldn't afford to stay in or eat at. We were camping, you know, we were living in our van. And then we drove up to the Cascades and backpacked in Olympic National Park, and then drove over to the Sierras and backpacked in Lassen National Park, and spent a lot of time in the backcountry and in rural areas in Northern California, and had a wonderful time. We had very little money. We had a car that I was, for the most part, capable of taking care of and fixing. I could do anything short of tearing down the engine. And so we were pretty self-sufficient. We ate a lot of canned food, freeze-dried food, and just lived a very simple life on the road. And it's how we got started 5 years later in one of those Northern California redwood forests. We did our first Insight meditation retreat together. So that is kind of how we got started as a couple. And so we decided that we wanted to the extent possible, to replicate that experience on our road trip this summer. And so we don't have our VW van anymore. But our daughters are grown and they're well seen too. We aren't going to have any grandkids. We just both retired recently as faculty at the University of Colorado, and had some savings put by. And so we decided that as an anniversary gift to ourselves, we would, and to the living world, we would buy an electric vehicle to take our trip. And my older daughter and her husband, he works as a data scientist doing renewable energy research for the power company for Xcel, and she works for the National Renewable Energy Lab. And so they had bought this vehicle, this Tesla, and we were very taken with it. And so we bought one too to take our trip. It was more than twice as much money than we'd ever spent on a motor vehicle before. It seemed like an incredible extravagance, but also as a, I don't know, kind of a gesture of kindness and generosity, both to each other and to the living world. So we set out on our trip, and we learned a whole bunch about how, you know, driving an electric vehicle is dependent upon charging stations is different from pulling up the nearest gas station. So that, you know, that was kind of a learning curve. We got out to the Bay Area. Our daughter had rented a beach house near Pescadero Beach, where she and my son-in-law and our other daughter and I and some friends, dear friends, Dharma friends from the Bay Area from 40, 50 years ago, came and stayed with us. And so we had a really wonderful reunion time on the beach. Within this, within this sense of community, this co-created place of sanctuary, bound together by the values that we all shared and our care for each other and whatnot. And then after that, we drove up the coast to Mendocino, and we stayed in one of these places that before we'd only admired from afar. And then headed into some of the more remote areas where we'd stayed. Came out of a having dinner at a little coastal restaurant in a remote part of Northern California at sunset to discover that one of our tires had been slashed. the people who designed and built this vehicle are people who are accustomed to having continuous cell phone access, because everything having to do with getting taken care of if you're in trouble has to do with being able to be on, you know, online. There was no cell phone access. And so with sunset, the tire was flat. We were out in the middle of nowhere. So we went back to the restaurant where we'd eaten and where it was just closing. And so we asked to borrow the phone and finally got through to the people that do roadside assistance for these kinds of matters. And so they said, oh, yeah, well, yeah. And we kept us on the line a long time while they looked to find a towing service that would come get our car and take it to a service center and also take us back to the B&B where we were staying. And so we slept in the car till about midnight or one, and then finally the tow truck, they dispatched it all the way from San Francisco, came and picked up the car and took us to our B&B and got the next morning, no cell service, asked to use the landline from the landlord where we were staying and tried calling the service center, but you can't call the service center. You could, every time I'd try to, ask for, use one of the options to get in touch with the service center, they said, well, use the app on your phone, which no connectivity. So finally we walked into town with our luggage, the nearest town, and I found a place where there was cell service and got in touch with them. They said, oh yeah, well, you can get a complimentary Uber service to the service center in San Rafael where your car is. And so we tried that, and there was no Uber service where we were. So we wound up taking a regional bus that came by about two or three times a day into San Rafael. And then we hiked a mile in 9-degree weather with our luggage to get to where our car was. And then we're on our merry way back up to Mendocino. And it was very humbling in a way, because, you know, the first time we'd done this trip, you know, you have a flat, you fix it. You have a problem with your engine, you fix it. This time you realize you become completely dependent upon the technical assistance available from the folks you bought the car from. And so then a couple of days in Mendocino, we ended up the backcountry up in near Lassen. You get off the beaten path, and the only way you can fuel an electric vehicle is by a much slower charging system that you find in like RV parks and trailer parks. And so we had arranged to stay in a place like that and charge our car there. And we got to the place and found that the plumbing was broken and there was no place for us to stay. So we had to drive way down the road to find a place to stay, and spent the next day, instead of spending it in Lassen National Park, we spend it in the RV park charging our car. and then we started on our way home. When we were on the road 50 years ago, the country is very riven by political divisions, just the way it is now. There are all kinds of signs whenever we were in rural areas saying America, love it or leave it. And the country is really being torn apart by those who favored the Vietnam War and those like us who were against it. So there is that kind of estrangement that we felt. But what we did not feel was any estrangement having to do with wealth or privilege, because we were penniless and we were living out of our car, you know, and that was quite evident. We're also self-sufficient. And so even though we would find our place, ourselves in places where, you know, our values weren't the same and our politics weren't the same, there was still this common sense of, you know, taking care of ourselves at a basic level and taking care of each other when we got in trouble. And so one of the things that really struck me about this trip was that there was an additional estrangement that I think we felt by virtue of being in this vehicle that bespoke privilege. You know, we were able to stay in nice places and whatnot. And later on, when I was doing research, I found that vandalism of Teslas is pretty common, both because it is a symbol of privilege, and also because it is a symbol of the demise of the fossil fuel industry. And so that's among the many things that is, you know, it's one of the tensions or the dynamics that's afoot in our country right now. We wanted to put up a little sign on the, you know, window of the car that said, "We're just a couple of retired teachers on a fixed income. Please don't trash our car." You know? Anyway, it's something we felt, you know, and the charging stations in the rural areas where we were, like in Kremlin, you know, there was a, in Kremlin, Colorado, there was a pickup truck we saw there that had a bumper sticker on it that said, "God bless our troops, especially the snipers." It was not a part of the, you know, we realized even here in Colorado, it wasn't a part of the, wasn't an environment where we felt necessarily at ease or at home, safe. And it was humbling and it was sobering in a couple of ways. One, because I think Abby and I thought of ourselves after 45 years of Dharma practice, you know, oh, we can be at home anywhere. You know, we have this sense of equanimity and inner balance and whatnot, that regardless of whether, whatever environment we find ourselves in, it's still possible to be at ease within ourselves. And we found that the longer we were on the road and the more time we spent in areas where we knew we had, you know, really very little in common in terms of values or anything with the people around us, that there was a feeling of aloneness, you know, of being estranged, of being kind of disconnected in a way. So the days when we took the time to sit before we went forth, maybe went for a little walk, we felt so much better anchored than the ones when we didn't. And then when we got back home again, back to the familiar. You know, and certainly on the road, I was not, especially in rural areas, was not expressive at all of my feminine side, in part because it just didn't feel safe, you know, and there was no real point in it. And then suddenly coming back home was like re-entering this, a place of safety, a place of security, the familiar, where suddenly it felt okay to be fully ourselves again. And for me, that was interesting because I had this image of myself previously of being able to be centered and secure and at ease everywhere. And then I realized that after a certain amount of time out there, you know, of going from a place of refuge into a place of exploration and adventure, that when we were with friends on the coast, for instance, it still felt wonderful, felt at ease at home and whatnot. But when we had gone into parts of the country where there weren't so many like-minded people, and where we need to really be understand and be respectful of the fact that we were in situations where people held very different values and very different ways of understanding what was right and how to relate to each other, that didn't feel at home, didn't feel safe, didn't feel at ease. And so we were eager to get back home where we did. So all this is by way of saying that what we touched upon during the trip, and I think something that is common to all of us, whether we go on road trips or whatnot, is that there are times, I believe, when we feel in the Dharma, when the mind is clear and the self-acceptance is strong, and we settle in, and the mind becomes capable of seeing and accepting everything, that the sense of being at home, of being safe, of being at ease, can be quite profound. Even if there's stuff going on, interpersonal stuff, health stuff, political stuff, still in all, that sense of being deeply rooted in who we truly are is accessible. It's there for us. And there are other times when it's not. Nothing else may have changed. We may still be in the house we live in. We may still have our friends and relations, but for whatever reason, the place of inner sense of being at home is not so evident, that there is more of a feeling of almost self-estrangement, of being on the outside looking in, of not being grounded or rooted. And just like when we were on the road, when those feelings arise, it can be hard to recognize and to accept them. But one of the things we also realized on the road is that when those feelings do arise, and you can recognize them, and you can accept them, that in some way, that is every much about being at home as when we are back in the place where we live. You know, that being at home is ultimately a state of mind. And so while it was difficult being out and about, you know, for more than a certain period of time, it was also a really powerful teaching about what being at home really means, and that it is as much about an inner state of mind as it is where we happen to be geographically or physically. So I am really grateful to be back home here in Denver and to be with you all in the Sangha. And I'm also grateful for what we learned on our trip. You know, and I think it was Dogen, the Zen poet, who said, you know, even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo's call, I long for Kyoto. So when we were out in California and we were on Pescadero Beach and we were in Berkeley, you know, where we lived for quite a long time, you know, it's like, Even in Berkeley, hearing the cuckoo's call, I long for Berkeley. Was longing for the Berkeley of 1971. Of 1984, when I graduated from law school, you know, on our trip, so much of what, without realizing it, so much of what we were longing for is what we experienced 50 years ago, rather than, you know, what we experienced this month. So being at home, we came to realize, is being at home in the moment, not in some distant memory. Okay, so it's a lot to put out there, so I'd really love to hear anyone else's thoughts or reflections or questions, please. Once.
Yeah, I'll mention something. You know,
Luke.
Yeah. Hi, Tara Lloyd. Many years ago, like you, I took a cross-country trip with Murshida, my teacher, and what happened was Murshid Issa said, "Hey, I bought a car in Mississippi," and he lived in California at the time, like he does now. "Would you guys go and pick it up?" You know, so we went over there and drove back, and, you know, it was like going through Americana. We'd be, I think it was in Mississippi or something, so we were in a black neighborhood, and we'd stop in, and there'd be black gentlemen, you know, was on the griddle, you know, making grits and, you know, stuff, things like that. And then we went through the Midwest, the farm area, and we'd be in these little cafes in this little town, a farming town. And, you know, there'd be a guy and his wife with his Peterbilt hat sitting there, and they'd not be saying anything, you know, because they said everything that they could, you know, for the decades, farmers, you know, drinking their coffee. And when we go in there, we could feel that every I was on us, because we obviously weren't from there, you know. And then we got to the point where we went through Vail, and then we just, you know, where there's the server, the lady has tattoos and blah, blah, blah. And you know, we fit right in, you know, no one looked twice at us, you know. But it was, you know, like that thing, like you were talking about, you know, what feels like home or not, you know. It was ended up being a very interesting experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Thank you. Okay. Anyway, so Paul.
Hi, Tara Lloyd. As I was listening to you, the word that came to mind was dissonance. It seemed as if there was an energy or a sound pattern that you and Abby had, and that it was not. There was an equal amount of energy that was out there, but those energies were just not connecting. It was just like this. Uh-huh. And so how did you, when you were in that place, how did you come to center to understand it? What was the process that you might have
maybe
wouldn't share?
Thank you, Paul. That's a good question. There's a phrase in, I think it's in the Dhammapada, where the Buddha is talking about whether you're feeling at home or whether you're feeling distant or dissonant. from another, where he said, see yourself and others, whom then can you harm? You know, it's similar to, but a little bit different from what Jesus of Nazareth said about, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know, it's a little bit transactional. And the Buddha kind of takes it a step further, and he says, see yourself in the other, just to say, you know, the other is no different than you. The other, the evident difference is illusory. That you need to be able to recognize that the essential humanity of the other is no different than yours, in terms of their feelings of aversion, of attachment, the blind spots, the delusions in their minds, the content of the aversion, the content of the attachment, the content of the delusion, of the ignorance may be different, but the mental functions are the same. So, so if you can remember that person has aversions just as I do, maybe it's aversion to me, huh? Maybe that's a projection. That person has attachments just like I do, although they may not be to the same thing. That person has blind spots. That person has things they choose not to see, just as I do, right? And that if it's possible, and it's one of the reasons we call it insight meditation, you know, if we have insight at some level into who we are and how our mind's functioning at a certain point in time, then that insight allows us to look beyond the appearances of the other, you know, whether they're not, they're wearing a Trump 2024 baseball cap or, you know, or whatever, you know. But to look at who's on the inside and to realize that whoever's in there is not really that different from us. And so it's kind of like, you know, a gestalt thing of, are you putting all your focus on the surface, or are you remembering that there is an essential being in there somewhere that's not that different than we are? And so on those mornings when we had gotten up early and sat and we're on good terms with each other, you know, then we would find ourselves in one of those sort of uncomfortable, you know, cultural situations. Then it was a little easier to ride with than it was at some other times. Thank you for asking the question. That's a good one. Okay. Well done. And so, and I remember from, you know, your time with your partner out on the ocean as a blue water sailor, I have no doubt there were times when you pulled into some port or other and tied up, and there was, you know, look at the draw, you know, turn of the wheel. There were probably others there that you might not necessarily see eye to eye, or, but, you know, if you encountered each other on the open ocean, you'd come to each other's aid. So it was nice to be able to relate, you know.
Yeah, I'm thinking of, you know, wherever I go, there I am.
Yes. Quite so, quite so. Good. Okay, thank you. Anyone else who'd like to share? Please, Don.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if anyone else is feeling not at home in Denver and not at home in the USA these days. You know, I've lived here for the last 51 years. It's been my home. But the longer I live here and the more I see what's going on, the less I feel like it's my home. Maybe that's the way everybody feels as they age in a place, you know. I mean, I knew people when I was younger who remembered Horse and Buggy in Denver, you know, so, but nonetheless, and then the larger picture, I'm sort of beginning to feel like I want to get the hell out of the country. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Not only with the political divisions, but with the guns and the, you know, the violence in general. And, you know, in the complex where I live, our mailboxes have been broken into 4 times now. So they've had to put up an iron gate across where the mailboxes are. You know, it's this kind of stuff that's making me feel like, do I want to stay here? Is this a place I want to live? You know.
So the feelings of estrangement for you arise from it feeling like it's a less safe place, a more alien place than it used to be?
Less safe, and I really hate the kind of developments that have taken over in this town. I mean, everywhere you look, there are these weird apartment buildings that, you know, look like they could fall like the one in Florida did. You know, I don't know. I'm saying that I'm feeling less at home.
Yes.
The place where I've called home for all these.
Yeah, because the environment around you is changing. I've only lived here 30 years, but I certainly have noticed the same thing, that the character of the community has changed, you know, especially with recent municipal administrations who seem to have given real estate developers sort of carte blanche, you know, and
yeah.
First they Manhattanized downtown, and now it looks like they're trying to Brooklynize the rest of the city. It's gulag style, you know, rectangular apartment buildings. But yeah, there's, I think there is an inevitable feeling of loss that when we feel like the aspects of the community where we live or whatnot, the things that we found charming and that we found appealing seem to be disappearing.
Yeah.
Right. I can hear that.
I remember when I used to go to the symphony and run into a half a dozen people I knew. Now if I go to the symphony, I don't know anybody.
Yeah, well, to some extent, I guess it's just the nature of the aging process. But
yeah, I think so.
There it is.
John, please try visiting the cemetery.
Why, you mean I'll see everybody I know in there, or what?
Those may become a thing of the past, too. You know, I'm increasingly taken with this law recently passed allowing you to compost yourself. Maybe there's some merit to that, you know. See yourself when you walk through the Rose Garden at City Park. Please, any others who wish to share something?
Hi, if no one else is in line, I would like to say something.
Is this Julia?
Yes.
Hi, Julia. I can see your little green phone on the screen, but nothing else.
That's shocking. It's white on my side.
Okay.
When I evacuated for the 4 mile fire, 2010, with my husband who was in a wheelchair and on oxygen at that time, but in a wheelchair anyway, we were evacuated for 10 days. And when we came back home, it was like, there was so much gratitude that the house was still standing. And
right.
And there was this feeling that the house itself was welcoming us back. And it's a log cabin, native wood, and it's kind of a living, breathing organism anyway.
Yes.
With all the creeks and the shifting,
yes,
and the expansion of heat and temperature. But it just seemed like there was something coming from the other side. I don't know if it was, you know, my projection bouncing off the walls and back at me or something. But, no, it really felt like the house itself, it was an entity. And that it,
yes,
was actually welcoming us back. And another thing I'd like to mention is that whenever we traveled and stayed in a hotel or something, it was kind of delicious to notice that, you know, we first walk into the room, the made-up room, but very quickly it became ours. You know, we appropriated everything to mine. This is mine, you know. And you may have noticed that. It's a very subtle feeling, but it's kind of interesting to watch the ego solidify and things like that.
Yeah, right. In the hotel, my room on the street, my parking place, in the grocery store, my grocery cart. You know.
Very good. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's what we do. You know, we kind of claim. You know, when I was in law school, my younger daughter was 2 years old, and she was at a time when in her preschool. Or daycare preschool, one of the things that we noticed is that when she was playing with the other kids and there was something she wanted, she'd grab it and say, mine. Anything that she wanted to play with, you know, she'd just, you know, lay her hand on it and say, mine, you know, and pull it towards her. And so when I was putting together my notebooks, you know, for my notes for my class, for that class, it was mine class, because, you know, studying all these principles of property law, at the end of the day, that's what it was about. It was all mine. What defines what is mine and what is not mine? How do I make what is yours mine? It's really primitive, you know, function of the mind, you know, appropriating that around us that we think we need in order to be safe and see to our needs. But I'm glad that you're homestead and that you were able to go back to it. Because we know of, in the case of so many others, that wasn't the way it was, right? I'm thinking, among other things, of the people living in that high-rise condo in Surfside, Florida, who went to bed as they had every other night for the last 40 years if they'd lived in the place since it was built. And all of a sudden, at their end, thinking of that which was solid and which was theirs was not. And that there had been ample forewarning of the fact the place was dangerous. And there's quite significant evidence that the place having been built on marshlands and landfill at the water's edge, even as the waters continue to insufflate the coastal lands, that it was probably not a great place to build a 12-story condo to begin with, and that those kinds of threats may be upon us on coastal cities in the way they were before. That which we thought was solid, safe, sanctuary, home, is not all that it seems to be. No. Thank you. Okay. Other sharing thoughts or questions, please. Going once, going twice. Okay.
I have one thought.
Oh.
Hey.
Who's this?
James.
Okay.
So,
James, yes, there you are.
I was thinking about, you know, places that we end up kind of out of necessity, and like how we can, you know, deal with a place that might not be perfect, but kind of that mind that wants to like optimize, you know, like there's a lot of places that are, you know, too expensive for a lot of people to live, you know, like you can write off a lot of New York, California, you know, just because you can't, you know, like the rent is going out of control. The I looked at this map, it said the median house price with a 40-year mortgage was like, you need to be making like at least $120,000 in California now to afford that. And I just try to think, like,
I went out of there 4 years ago. Yeah.
And it's just so nuts. And like, so, you know, people or, you know, I work with refugees at the library, and, you know, they might be somewhere where they never imagined themselves being, you know, but they had to come here out of necessity. And, you know, it's just kind of interesting to think, like, you know, when we choose a place, right, like, I'm always getting hit by, like, the grass is always greener kind of stuff. Thinking about places that, you know, I'd only be happy if I were, you know, somewhere else.
Right.
And, like, trying to square that away with, like, you know, like, you know, I have a good job here. I feel like I have more job prospects here than other places. And trying to, like, line that up, you know? Like, it's so funny that this was a topic today because I was thinking kind of a lot recently. I didn't get this new position that I wanted. And I was trying to think, like, am I going to go back home to Chicago or not? But, you know, maybe this would be the wiser option of the two just for, like, job prospects, because I'm still working at Denver and, you know, have a good in there. But, you know, I guess it's kind of this idea of, like, idealizing, like, another place and, like, trying to think about things might be easier there.
Right, yeah. Right. What is it that makes a place a home? What is it that makes a place you'd like to be?
Right, exactly. Because sometimes, like, I feel like I've noticed this idea of, like, thinking this is, like, my city here in Denver. And sometimes it leads to, like, worse things because then I start criticizing everything. I say, oh, man, that intersection's so ugly. What if, you know, what if our administration was not, you know, like, evicting homeless people all over, you know, like, and obviously those are bad things, like, period, but the more I think of it as, like, my city, I think it makes it harder, to be honest, which is interesting.
Yeah, I think that to some extent that is the price of sentience, you know. Sometimes I think that the feeling of disconnectedness or isolation or lack of rootedness is something that we take on in self-defense. You know, it's like, if I don't allow myself to feel connected or part of what's around me, then I'm less likely to be harmed. I'm less likely to feel negatively affected. But when you begin to allow yourself to feel a part of that which is around you, you know, one of the things when we first moved here in 1986, we were moving from the San Francisco Bay Area, from the Berkeley Albany area, which was quite ethnically and culturally diverse, and we were accustomed to that. That was a milieu social environment that we were comfortable with, you know, that we felt at home in. And so when we were out here, and I'd been offered this teaching job at the University of Colorado, they'd lined us up with a realtor to go out looking at houses. And so we got in her car and she was driving us around, and we were driving through Denver, you know, we were driving through, you know, places, you know, like down to Wash Park and Cap Hill and Park Hill. And we're saying, wow, it looks really nice. So you don't want to live in Denver. The schools are crappy and there's a lot of crime and, you know, racial discord. And she kept driving us out to Aurora, you know, and we're saying, yeah, but no, we kind of liked it back there. So, because she had a lot of properties to sell, you know, out in Aurora. Or she took us down to Littleton. And so we're saying, yeah, but we think it's kind of nice in Denver, you know. There's, like, neighborhoods there where we might be able to afford a house. And so finally we had to, you know, part ways with that person. And because there was something that, and one of the things that we really found attractive in Denver, in addition to the cultural diversity, it's just like all the trees, you know, there's this, the integration of the residential areas and the natural surroundings, we found to be just like really rich. And so we did wind up settling in, you know, neighborhood here in Denver. And doing so, you get caught up in it. And then when they do start whacking down trees and scraping off lots and putting in these but ugly rectangular apartment buildings, and you can see the character and the vibrance of the, you know, what makes the city feel alive, kind of being drained away a little bit. It's painful. It really is, you know, but and it's difficult to deal with. But it also, I think, that sentience is also a call to become involved. You know, if what makes this place feel alive and nourishing to you is being threatened, you know, then maybe it's worth doing something about. Maybe it's worth getting involved, you know, and you do that and all of a sudden you find out there's a bunch of other people that feel the same way. And so you start to get a little bit more plugged into the social networks as well as, you know, your sense of attachment to, in a good way, you know, sense of relationship to the environment. And then that's one of the things that I think that's another defining characteristic of home, you know, a place that nourishes you. I belong here. You know, there's something about this environment that's giving back to me, you know, that I feel nourished by. Good. Thanks for sharing that, James.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else, anybody? Okay. That being the case, I think I'd like for us to end our time together this evening by calling in some reinforcements for a sense of well-being and being at home in the form of the devas, the beneficent beings that in ancient Buddha Dharma were thought to cohabit this environment with us. And to the extent that we acknowledge their presence or acknowledge the possibility of their presence, the way the Buddha put it was, whatever beings there may be, you know, both seen and unseen, you know, the devas of Denver, the devas of your own practice. So let's settle in, find our sitting posture if we can. Once more, allow the eyes to gently close and attention to come to rest on the breathing. Vavatu sava mangalam, rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Sava buddha nivadena, Sarasvati Bhavangute. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Sava Dhamma Nubhavena Sala Sati Bhavantute. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Sangha Vavena Sava Soti Bhavantute. By the power of all the Sangha, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Thanks for coming around this evening. Stay safe and be well. Have a good week.
Thanks, dear Lloyd. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, dear Lloyd.
Thanks. What would you like to call your talk?
Let's call it Home and Away.
Thank you.
Recording stopped.